The National Rifle League 22 November Course of Fire, this week on Mail Call Mondays. I'm John McQuay with 8541 Tactical, and this is Mail Call Mondays, the show that answers your questions about precision rifles, optics, and equipment. Welcome to the Mail Call Mondays, and this Monday we are going to talk about the November Course of Fire for the National Rifle League 22 matches. And this weekend, I actually switched it up a little bit. I went over to the Benchrest Rifle Club of St. Louis in Wright City, just outside of St. Louis, and shot the National Rifle League 22 November Course of Fire with their club. And they had been asking me to come over for quite some time. Jason McBride is the match director over there, and he asked me to come over and check out their matches, and they have a really, really nice facility over there. The entire firing line is underneath cover, so if it's raining, if it's snowing, etc., then you have some cover. The day started out pretty chilly, but we had pretty decent temperatures throughout the day, and it was really a beautiful day to be on the range and to shoot. Now, this is interesting because the National Rifle League publishes a course of fire for each club to do every month. And it's understood that most clubs will shoot the same course of fire. Now, you can add stages. And if, in this case, the St. Louis Club added two stages at the end that we will talk about. But they also had a slight twist on one of the stages that I'll talk about as we went through. Now, their club is one of the larger clubs that I've shot 22 matches at. They had about 30 shooters for this match, so they broke it up into four squads, and then we went through and we shot the seven stages, so the five regular stages and then two additional stages, just right down the line. So it was very quick, it was very easy just to rotate through. Everything ran smoothly. Each different squad had a squad leader that would read the stage and then make sure the rules were being adhered to. And as we saw as we went through, this caused a little bit of deviation from squad to squad. As I went back and shot some pictures of some of the other shooters shooting the stages, I noticed there were some different interpretations. And again, we'll talk about that as we go through each of the stages. But overall, the match ran very smoothly, and it was very, very enjoyable to go out to run into a different group of shooters and really enjoy the sport with them. They were very accommodating. They were just great to stand off to the side and BS with. And I will definitely be back to shoot some more matches out there at their facility. So now let's get into the course of fire. And the first stage for the November course of fire is titled, "It's Like Playing with My Brother's Kids." And this was a card stage. And this is actually, I'm going to go through it the way the course of fire is set up. I'm going to go through them in the order that the course of fire actually reads them out. So, as is usual, all these courses of fire had a 120-second time limit and a 10-round round count. It was 100 points possible if you cleaned the stage. The ranges on the target for this, it was a 2.5-inch steel target on a single hanger at 75 yards. The equipment allowed was one bag that's approximately the size of a volleyball or smaller, and I used a Weebad Mini Fortune cookie for the entire course of fire. That was the only bag that I used on this whole month's course of fire. The start position was the rifle grounded, mag in, and bolt back. So rifle sitting next to the starting line on the ground. On the start, the RO will shuffle five cards. The shooter will take each card and lay it face down from left to right. On the start signal, the shooter will turn over the cards in the order they put them face down. The number on each card will represent the step you will shoot from left to right. So when they said shooter ready, engage, you would then flip over all the cards that were on the bench, and the order that the cards came up, so ace is one, two is two, three is three, etc., to the five, that's the order that you would shoot the steps on the step ladder. And there's probably going to be some difference in this from club to club. For us, They pointed out that the lowest rung is 1, and then it was 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Now, if you did have a shorter shooter that was not able to reach the top step, then an accommodation could be made and other steps could be designated. So if they couldn't get to that fifth step, then they could maybe shoot on the fourth step as number 5. So that was up to the individual match directors to how they can accommodate for that. After turning the cards over, the shooter will then engage the 75-yard target with 2 shots from the step matching the first card. Shooter will then shoot the remaining steps in the order of the cards on the ground. If someone's not tall enough to reach step number 5, the match director will substitute another number that the shooter will shoot from. So the stage is pretty straightforward. Now, the confusion here came from some people not really reading the directions very closely. And I saw a couple of the other squads that did this a little bit differently. What we did on the shoot was we laid the cards out on the start signal. You flip the cards over, you grab your stuff, you jump up on the barricade or on the ladder, and you start shooting the steps. So that way you could look at the cards and you could possibly quickly memorize the order of the cards and then go to the steps and not have to look back at the cards. A couple of the other squads I noticed, they would start, the shooter would flip the card over, grab their gun, get up on the first step, fire the first position, then go back, flip the card over, and go back and shoot the next one, then flip the next card over, and then shoot the next one. There's 2 problems with doing it this way. Now for us, the ladder was right in front of a concrete bench, so you were actually almost within arm's reach of your rifle as you turned around and flipped a card over. So it wasn't that big of a deal in this setup. But if you were on an unimproved range and you were flipping the cards over on the ground, then that's a problem because you might be leaving the rifle on the ladder while you reach down and flip cards. Now, with this rig here, since it's balanced out specifically to be able to sit on barricades nice and stable, I could have done that, and unless it was a really windy day, it wouldn't have been a problem. But especially when you get down into base class with some of these lighter weight rifles, the rifle is not going to stay solidly on the barricade. Then you run into a position where you may have a loaded rifle teetering on a barricade while a shooter comes off of it. And that's a bad situation to be in. So it does cause a safety risk. So for that, I believe that's why they decided in the course of fire to flip all cards over before you touch the rifle. That way the cards are flipped over. Worst comes to worst, you have to go look at the cards again. But you don't have to come off the gun and manipulate anything else in order to get to the next step in your firing sequence. For me, my memory has gotten worse as I've gotten older, so I did occasionally look back at the cards on the table to see what my next step was before moving to the next one, and that to me was a minimum amount of extra time added to the stage, but it still allowed me to maximize the accuracy of going to the next one. After you figured out which step you're supposed to be on, it was fairly straightforward at that point. It's just getting the rifle stable and firing your shots. I came off the stage with 70 points on it. I did have one little flub where I went to move to the next step and I dropped the bag. And I was actually on the highest step at that point. And when I dropped the bag going to the highest step, I looked down and decided for 2 shots, it was a little bit too much time to come off the step, reach down, grab the bag, put the bag back on the step, get the rifle back in position, and then fire. So I just went ahead and stabilized it, got my 2 shots. I believe I got both hits on that before I moved to the next step. So that was fine. But obviously I dropped 3 shots somewhere on the ladder. And it was probably because I was rushing. Very often, when I drop shots on the ladder, it's because I rush the shots. 2 minutes is an eternity for a stage like this. So you just have to slow down and get your hits. So that was stage 1. Fairly straightforward, other than the little confusion with the cards. Now this is where, with a match director, or one guy briefing each stage and making sure that each stage is run. That can smooth those things out, but with 30 shooters and several squads, it's not realistic unless the match director is not shooting, and in this case, Jason was shooting the match as well. It's not realistic for them to be able to make sure every shooter gets the exact same briefing. So that's why when we are reading off of these, it's really important to read the directions and then follow the directions to the letter. There actually were a couple of times where I looked at and noticed that we were doing something slightly different than the exact directions. Now, overall, in the grand scheme of things, if you make a slight change in the course of fire as a match director, it doesn't really matter because the match is scored based upon the curve that's established in your club. So the top guy gets his 100 points and everybody else gets points based off of the top shooter as far as the scores that are reported to national. But you don't want to drastically change it because then it changes the whole intent and the whole flavor of the match. So that's my opinion on that. So the next stage, stage two, was a barricade stage, and it's titled, I'm Too Full to Get This Low. On this one, we had two cinder blocks, and we had a five-gallon bucket as the barricades. The ranges to the target, there was a swing set set out, and it was a 0.25-inch target, a 0.5-inch, and a 0.75-inch target, and they were set at the 25-yard line. The equipment allowed was one bag that's the size of a volleyball or smaller. And again, I use the WeBad Mini Fortune Cookie. For the start position, the rifle was resting on top of the left cinder block. And this cinder block was laying flat on the ground. The bucket, the 5-gallon bucket, was sitting next to it, upside down. And then another cinder block was sitting to the right of the bucket, sitting on the long side, so sitting on the tall dimension. The start position's rifle resting on top of the left cinder block, mag in and bolt back. Shooter will announce which target they wish to shoot out of the three targets and engage their target of choice with three rounds from the left cinder block. So three shots on the left cinder block on whichever of the three you call out. Shooter will then move to the top of the bucket and engage their target of choice with four rounds. Shooter will then move to the center block on the right and engage their target of choice with three rounds. Shooter may change targets at any time, but must announce the change. If the shooter is engaging the same target, it is not necessary to announce it. Match director note is when the shooter calls their target, have the spotter repeat it to confirm that the spotter knows which target is being engaged. So this one, you can see the targets. I kind of like this the way it's set up because when you get the rifle set up, you're going to obviously have your dope dialed in. You're going to have your parallax dialed in. You only have 1 yard line to worry about, so only one setup for the gun. So when you get on target, if you find, especially if you're a newer shooter, you start to find that you're missing shot after shot, just go to a bigger target. Just shift to a bigger target. Get some points, and then you won't feel so bad about misses. You'll have some fun, and you'll get some things moving. So having the targets lined up just like that, it makes it very easy just to shift over. Just remember to call that you're shifting to the next target and arrange with the spotter beforehand what they want to hear. If they want to hear left, middle, right, or if they want to hear small, medium, big, whatever, just make sure that is confirmed beforehand. For this, for me, I am fairly stable on these kinds of barricades, this real low setup. Again, this gun is set up to do that very well. So I stayed on the small target for the entire thing. Now, again, a 0.25-inch target at 25 yards is not a super difficult target as long as you slow down, take your time, and get good shots. But the target is very narrow, but the target is very tall, because on the actual NRL 22 official target package, that 0.25 swinger is the same size at the bottom as it is at the top. So you have this really long stick, and you can hit anywhere along it. So especially when you're using a gun that is zeroed at 50 yards, like mine is, I cheat high on that target. So I won't shoot right down at the very tip. I will come up about half to three quarters of an inch on that target and aim higher up there. I can still hit it hard enough to swing it, but you get two things there. One is you're hitting it higher up, so it is not going to spin as fast, so you'll it'll calm down quicker for your next shot. But then also, if you are a little bit low or a little bit high on your dope or on your setup or on your trigger pull, then you're still actually going to hit the target and actuate it. And most clubs don't require any kind of full spin or anything. If you move the target with the bullet, they call it a hit. So I will aim high. That's a little bit of a tip on that. Now, if you get out to more extended ranges and you get out to the larger spinners, that may not be wise, because at the more extended ranges, wind is having a greater effect and the target is narrower, higher up than it is right down at the bottom on the actual strike face. So just keep that stuff in mind. The second tip on these, or any of the swing set type targets, is if you pop it with a solid hit, especially the smaller ones, they will spin pretty rapidly. You have 2 minutes to get 10 shots off. Wait for it to come to a stop. Don't try to hit it on the move. I have tried that before. It has cost me points before. The only time I will try to hit the target on the move is if I only have seconds left and it's still going and I got to get it off. Because then might as well fire the shot at it and get a zero, then time out with that bullet still in the chamber. It gives me the same score no matter which direction. So that's just one to keep in mind. Now, as I mentioned, this gun is set up very well to be able to shoot these stages. And the reason it's set up that way is the chassis, the MDT ACC chassis that we have on here, the WeBad Mini Fortune Cookie fits perfectly right in front of the mag well here. And that is where I have set this up to balance on. The mag well is low profile. It's even with the trigger guard here. And on the Tika T1X, the magazine fits up into the well here. So I don't have anything protruding. Like, for instance, if this was a Voodoo in the same chassis, that 10-round magazine protrudes down the bottom quite a bit. So on this gun, I can get the balance point set up here, and I can scoot it fairly forward on the barricades and have nothing extending down here. The Mini Fortune Cookie takes up all the space in here, and I still don't have the magazine dragging or anything. If I was shooting a Voodoo, then I have that magazine sticking down. I need to make sure that I don't push this forward and start getting that magazine interfering with the barricade, because then it can jack the rifle up and it can cause some problems. So that is a huge benefit, shooting the Tika, overshooting something that's got a longer magazine. Even the CZ-455s or 457s, the 10-round magazines, or this curved magazine that hangs down there. So that is a problem. Again, rifles like the Ruger Precision Rimfire don't have that problem, because the magazine, again, sticks up way inside the magazine well, so you have a nice flat area here. So that and the balance point of the gun works very well. It allows me to load the rifle right over the scope ring here and get it centered up on there, and then just concentrate on breaking clean shots. Because the Tika here has a very smooth, very fast bolt handle, it has hardly any disruption on the position as I run the bolt and get my shots off. Now, like any of our other stages, movement is key. So as soon as you break that third shot, don't worry about grading it. Don't worry about seeing where it went to. Move the rifle. Get on to the next barricade and get set up. I will usually shoot kneeling on these, but that first barricade was low enough that I could go prone behind it. But the bucket and then the last cinder block, I shoot really low kneeling. So that's just really what works for me. I saw a lot of guys would go into a sitting position For me, a sitting position is too slow moving to the different positions because I have to sit down, I have to kick my legs forward, and then when it's time to move, I have to move up, move over, whereas with the kneeling, I can just pick the gun up, set it, slide my body over, get behind the next position, and go. So that was stage two. Let me go on to stage three. And stage three was a paper stage for most of the clubs shooting this. It's called Wrong Side You Jive Turkey. And this was a support side stage. So I'm going to go through this two ways. I'm going to brief it the way the actual NRL course of fire is. And then I'm going to talk about some changes that they made at the Bench Rest Rifle Club of St. Louis to accommodate their specific situation. So this one was actually, time limit was 90 seconds. So normally we have this 120 second time limit, and this one it dropped down to 90 seconds. The round count was 10, and the equipment is one bag that's approximately the size of a volleyball or smaller. You started with the rifle grounded, standing behind the rifle, mag in, and bolt back. On the start signal, shooter will drop behind the rifle on the weak side, which means opposite eye and hand, and engage the target's alternating left, then right target. Again, this is on paper targets. Now, because the Bench Rest Club of St. Louis had 30 shooters, setting out 30 paper targets is not difficult, but keeping track of who is on what target, making sure that there are no people shooting other targets, making sure that throughout the rest of the stage that another target doesn't inadvertently get shot, can become a little bit of an annoyance for a match director. Then you have to either decide to leave the targets up there and each squad shoots the paper stage and then you wait until the end to go cold and go downrange and score them. Or you go cold after each squad and have that squad go down and score them. So paper stages really can be a pain in the butt. I very often, when we shoot paper stages, I see shooters shoot on the wrong target. You can give them shooter numbers right before they engage, and then they still end up, they get in the scope, they get that narrow field of view, and they end up shooting on the wrong target, especially when you get into a funky feeling position like shooting support side. So, St. Louis, they made a little bit of a change to it, and they shoot on steel targets. So how they do this is they will go out to the same range, so it was still 100 yards, but instead of shooting on paper, they had corresponding steel targets. Now, this actually was a little bit more difficult, because if I recall correctly, the target corresponding to a center hit on the paper target was a 0.25, so quarter inch target. The next target that would correspond to the 7-inch scoring ring on the paper target was a 0.5 inch, and then the larger target corresponding to a 5-point scoring ring was a 3/4 inch target. Now, this stage, the way they set it up, is actually more difficult than shooting the paper stage. Because the paper stage, obviously, if you aim for the center of the target, which you would on every single shot, if you aim for the center of the target and you miss it by 0.5 inch, you're still getting points for that shot. You won't get the 10 points that you were trying for, but you may hit one of the outer scoring rings and still accumulate points for that shot. This way, if I was aiming for that quarter inch target, fired on that quarter inch target, and missed it by 0.5 inch. Well, let's say I even missed it by 0.25 inch, which would normally be into that 8 ring or so. That's a zero. I got a zero for that shot. So it definitely has an increased level of difficulty. Now, again, they made the accommodation for their club. Every shooter in that club had to shoot the same stage of fire in the same way. It required the same skills necessary, the same shooting position, the same equipment and everything. It was just how the scores were tabulated was different for this club than the other club. And they did run this through NRL 22 National before they decided to do it. So it wasn't just kind of an outlaw thing. There was a discussion about it before they decided to do it. But this is something we've seen kind of across the country where match directors are switching things around to make accommodations. And we're starting to get into kind of a gray area here where are we doing it because it's difficult because of the club or because of the arrangement or that to shoot the course of fire the way it's specified, or are we doing it because we just don't like the course of fire the way it's specified? And I think in this case, this is an accommodation that allows their match to run a lot smoother, a lot quicker, and get a lot of shooters through rapidly. So I don't necessarily have a problem with the way Jason decided to set this course of fire up. I thought it was kind of a novel solution to the question. But then the question that we really come down to is they were using the NRL 22 official target package. So it gets to the point of asking why National continues to do paper stages when they could go to a steel stage like that. So is there an idea behind it where they think that something is being lost by taking out the paper stages versus leaving them in? I do see that since paper stages tend to have a wider gap of scores, paper stages can tend to eliminate the need to have a tiebreaker at the end because your scores can come down into, you know, 1 or 2 point differences, whereas when you're always shooting steel, the larger gap you may have may be a 10-point difference between the two, so you may have 3 or 4 shooters with the exact same score, whereas the paper stage might have broken them up with a point or two between. So that's just kind of my opinion on that, but I really would like to hear you guys. How do you feel about making accommodations like this to the NRL 22 course of fire? Do you think it is outside of the spirit of the game, or do you think it's just okay? Really kind of want to hear that down below, so leave a comment in the comment section, please. And then we have stage number 4. Stage number 4 is, thanks for giving me a good win call. I really like this stage. We go back to the 120-second time limit, 10-round count, and the ranges and targets, everything was at 100 yards. You had a 5-inch single hanger. You had a 3 and a 2.5-inch on a double hanger. You had a 2 and a 1.5-inch on a double hanger. Points possible were 5 for the 5-inch, 7 for the 3-inch, 10 for the 2.5, 13 for the 2, 15 for the 1.5. And the total possible points were 100. The equipment for this is one bag that's approximately the size of a volleyball bag or smaller. And again, I used the WeBad Mini Fortune Cookie. The start position is rifle grounded with the shooter in position, mag in, and the bolt back. On the start signal, shooter will engage the targets from big to small, hit or miss. So if you missed, you still went on to the next target. Once the shooter has engaged the 1.5-inch target, which is the last target, they will then start back at the 5-inch target and engage the targets big to small again. So big to small, and then back up big to small. On the second run, the shooter must hit to move on. So the second one, if you missed that 5-inch target, you had to stay on the 5-inch target until you went to the next one. So really is kind of a cool stage, and the way they have the targets organized there, you could see all the targets in one field of view if you didn't have your scope really, really cranked up. So you could see where they were all at. It really, for me, it was like a gas pedal drill because I knew really that 5-inch, 3-inch, and the 2.5-inch at 100 yards were gimmies. I could drill those targets just as quick as I could run the bolt and go to the next target. But then those last two, the 2-inch and the 1.5, you had to hit the brakes and then make sure that you engage those well. And then again, you could start over and run through it again. Now, if I took more time, I might have been able to clean it. I dropped 3 on this one, so I came off of it with 70 points. But It was a really fun stage. I think this one was probably my favorite stage of the month. So it was great fun to run through it. I think that the large size selection of targets would give even our novice shooters quite a few points. But that 1.5 at the end, especially right after you hit the 2 and things are kind of shaking around a bit, the 1.5 could be a little bit of a challenge, especially if you had a little bit of wind, and we did have a little bit of wind. You could actually see the mirage moving. If you didn't account for it, you would miss. And I actually think one of my misses was I was in the process of breaking the shot and watched the wind stop. So I was a little bit too aggressive on my wind hold and kicked it off to the on hold side. So very straightforward, not really anything crazy on that one. Then we come to stage number 5, which is what's this gobbledygook? And this was our positional stage. Almost every month, it seems there is a positional stage that you could shoot with a sling. So again, 120 second time limit for this, 10 round count. And the ranges and targets are a 1 inch at 25 yards on a single hanger, 2 inch at 50 yards on a single hanger, 3 inch at 75 yards on a double hanger, and a 4 inch at 100 yards on a double hanger. So all of the targets were 4 MOA targets. So the interesting thing about it is on the gun, the targets all appear the same size because they are all the same angular size as you go out. So really the wobble area was could be pretty close for each and every target. Most of us just decided to go for the 4 inch at 100 yards because that really looked like the most solid target out there. For this, I shot it with a sling. I used a Tab PRS sling. I'm still trying to get used to the sling, but the more I use it, the more I'm getting it dialed in for my style and how I like to shoot it. I'm also figuring out which attachment points on the gun seem to work best for that sling. Now, the Tab PRS sling is interesting because you don't sling up in it the way you would a normal Hasty sling, and it is not a loop sling, so you don't have the cuff on your arm. It's more of a patrol sling, so you would have it slung across you, cross body, and then when you get down behind the gun, you wrap your arm in it however you need to get the tension on it. So you could not use any support. It was an unsupported stage, and I'll go ahead and read through the start position, and then I'll talk to you about a little bit of details on this. Equipment was one sling only. So it's the only equipment allowed. You can't use a bipod, can't use a bag, nothing. The start position is rifle, port arms, mag in, bolt back. On the start signal, the shooter will establish an unsupported prone position. They will then announce which distance they shoot at and engage that distance. Shooter may change the distance at any time, but must announce the change. If the shooter is engaging the same distance, it is not necessary to announce. Match director note is when the shooter calls their distance, have the spotter repeat it to confirm that the spotter knows which distance is being engaged. So fairly straightforward. The difficulty for me is going from standing to prone without jamming the muzzle into the ground. I had to be really careful when I came down that I didn't have the muzzle on the ground. Now, I did keep the bipod on the gun, but the bipod was folded. I feel that that is acceptable within the spirit of the game because if you had one of the M-Lock style bipods that was solidly affixed to the gun, you're not going to take out tools and start taking pieces off your gun. So as long as the bipod is folded and not actually aiding in any support, obviously no bags whatsoever. For me, I shot it straight up the way the stage is written. It's intended to be a slung-supported prone stage, so that is the way I shot it. Now, we did have some other shooters that we saw that changed up and used an alternate position. And the position I'm talking about is commonly referred to as the Hawkins position. And that is where you will take your fist. Commonly, you grip the sling with your fist and use your fist to support the fore end of the rifle. Now, depending upon the configuration of the ground that you're on and where the target is placed, Hawkins can be very effective. Hawkins is usually used when you have to shoot downhill. So you have a lower position in front of the gun than you do at your shoulder, so you get that incline and you can shoot down. In my opinion, Hawkins is still an unsupported position because you are only using your body to support the rifle. So if the terrain and then the targets allow, I see Hawkins as an acceptable position for this stage. The main reason being, since it is only your body that you are using to support the gun, it is something that everyone that comes to that match has. Everyone that comes to the match has their body. I would assume that most people that are shooting the match have both hands. If not, then obviously accommodations can be made for handicapped shooters to make it fair for them to shoot. But there was I posted a picture on Instagram and there was a lot of comment about it. Now, the young lady whose picture I posted, she was shooting with her fist actually underneath her folded bipod on the forend. And I don't know if that was specifically intended to try to game it or if it was just that's what she saw as working well. Fist under the bipod, we then start to get into the argument, well, is fist supporting the folded bipod? Well, next we could go fist supporting the extended bipod, and then I think that may be taking it a little too far. I think in this instance, she was just trying to make the position work best for her and shoot it. I don't necessarily know if it was gaming the position. But again, we start to run into these things where it wasn't specifically written in here that you had to use a standard slung prone position. There were a lot of shooters that shot a standard prone position without a sling. So there was a wide variety of difficulty there. Now, again, the bipod thing, if this was a pro shooter that came in and started doing that stuff, I would say, okay, that's gaming the system. If it is a newer shooter and they were just doing what felt right, I don't have a problem with it at all. Again, that's going to come down to a match director's call. And again, we run into this thing where it is the club level. The way the NRL 22 is set up is everyone in the club is just basically shooting against everyone else in the club. The difficulty does not really exceed outside of the club other than just kind of looking at scores and going, huh, you know, see how I did compared to this guy over here on the other side of the country. You still really can't do that because maybe you're shooting on a windy range in the rain, in the snow, and they're shooting on a nice sunny, calm day. The scores are obviously going to be different between those two. So that's why it's staggered and scored the way it is between the clubs, and then the clubs' points are then compared to other clubs across the nation. So again, I don't necessarily have a problem with it. Where I would have a problem is if somebody came in and said something like, you know, I don't like these sling stages. We're just going to shoot this bipod and rear bag. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all because that's totally not the whole idea behind here. The idea behind these positional stages is for the shooter to practice unaided firing of their rifle. What you do if your bipod broke, your bipod fell out, you didn't bring a bipod, you're shooting a hunting rifle, you know, any of that stuff. It's important to be able to utilize your rifle in a variety of different situations. I have heard a lot of shooters say that they absolutely hate unsupported stages. Well, lots of people hate them because they are very difficult. You start to get heavier rifles, and it makes it more difficult to support them in some of the positions. It takes more discipline to do your dry fire, do your snapping in, and get used to those positions. Get used to that bone support, muscular relaxation, and most of the time, if you are in a good, tight, sling-supported position, it's painful. It is not a comfortable position to be in. You don't like to be in it for long because you start to cut off blood flow to things. Your hand starts to get numb, etc. But you can survive it for the couple of minutes that you need to get the shots off. and then you come out of the sling and rest. So I like the fact that the NRL 22 keeps these unsupported positions where you either have to use a sling or you have to go without a sling, but you have to support the rifle with your body. If we start to get into these and you start to see guys use things like rollover prone, where you're resting the rifle across your legs and shooting it, well, now we start to get a little bit outside of the intent of the stage. So again, we're starting to get into this little bit of gray area, and I'm seeing this on the comments on some of the forums where match directors kind of want to do their own thing, and then it's not really an NRL 22 match anymore, it's just a rimfire match. So again, I really want to hear what you guys think about it. How do you feel about things like that? How do you feel about using a Hawkins position instead of a standard prone position? Do you see that as cheating or as gaming it? Or do you see that as just, hey, making things work and going on with it? Remember, the Hawkins position has been around since pre-Revolutionary War. The earliest I have seen it is in some marksmanship manuals around the Revolutionary War time period. So Hawkins is a very, very old position. It's not something that someone just came up with to try to game the system with our new fancy rifles. So that's all I'm going to say about that. Now I'm going to talk about two of the very interesting stages that they had set up there that were just auxiliary stages. Now, before I start to talk about the individual stages here, this has been an argument that I've seen again pop up on like the NRL Advisors board on Facebook and some other things where guys have the capability to run some rather unique stages, but they lament that the NRL 22 stages sometimes seem kind of simple or they recycle the same kind of ideas or that. Well, the way it was set up is at an NRL 22 match, there's nothing to say that the five published stages for the month are the only stages you can run. In fact, match directors are encouraged to come up with creative stages and side stages and that. Hopefully you stay within the intent of what the NRL 22 matches are, but you can be very creative. There are clubs that have movers that will run mover stages. We've looked into getting a mover for our local club that just adds a little bit of variety to it. There are clubs that have more than 100 yards that will run long-range stages. So they may throw a 300-yard stage into their course of fire at the end. So you have a ton of possibilities as long as you're running it safely and you're running it fair, so something that it doesn't make it incredibly difficult for a base class shooter to do, then I think it's a great thing to throw some of these auxiliaries in. We will probably do a little bit of an auxiliary stage at our local match this month. So they had two stages at the Benchrest Rifle Club of St. Louis, and the first auxiliary stage was stage number 6, and it was called the Wheel of Misfortune, and they actually had a big wheel that you had to spin. The round count was 10 rounds, time limit was 2 minutes, gear allowed was 1 bag and 1 bipod. Target value is 10 points per impact. The targets and ranges were actually listed on the wheel, so I'll post a picture of the wheel because I can't remember all of the target distances right now. On the stage description is, shooter will engage the targets following the direction of their designated wheel spinner. So you had to ask someone else in the squad to spin the wheel for you. The shooter will begin with all gear in hand, chamber flag inserted, magazine removed, standing port arms near the firing line. So you had to start in the most difficult position you possibly could because your flag had to still be in the gun. And on this guy, I forgot my nice fancy chamber flag, so I was actually just using a centerfire chamber flag with it inserted vertically, so it went down through the mag well just to make sure that the bolt could not go forward into battery. The way the scope is set up and the scope base, it actually had to bend it a little bit to pull it out, so it was not easy to get my chamber flag out quickly. So I had to kind of pre-stage it on this. But again, that's the most difficult position that you could possibly start in because you can botch trying to get your chamber flag out. You can jack up loading the magazine. Just there's all kinds of stuff. On the start signal, the shooter's chosen wheel spinner will spin the wheel, and the wheel must make at least one full rotation. The wheel spinner will then announce to the shooter which targets to engage and how. The first engagement will be done with 5 rounds. The shooter's wheel spinner will then spin the wheel a second time, must make at least one full rotation, and the shooter will follow the directions given by the wheel spinner for their final 5 rounds. The wheel spinner may not spin the wheel for the second part of the stage until the command is given by the shooter to spin the wheel. So, the wheel had all kinds of crazy stuff on there to include have someone else shoot your rifle. It was really kind of interesting. So, part of this is the devil's in the details. So you had to read the directions. You had to understand the directions because your wheel spinner, first of all, needed to spin the wheel hard enough to make one revolution. But if you really crank that thing, you could sit there while the clock's running and the wheel's spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. So you wanted to make one revolution, but you wanted it to stop pretty quickly so you could get into position. The one full revolution also kind of stopped your buddy from gaming it and giving you an easy one, because there were some easy ones on there, like just engage the targets near to far from prone. The targets were all within 100 yards, so there was nothing that was really crazy on this. And then the second part of it was you had to spin again for that last 5 rounds, but it didn't say when you had to spin again. So I screwed this one up because I waited until my last shot to tell him to spin again. I should have, as soon as I heard what I had to do on the first 5, told him to spin again. So I have my directions for the second 5 before I stopped shooting the first string. So that was just kind of a tip on this that I'll remember if I have to do one of these stages again. None of mine were very difficult. They were pretty much straightforward prone shooting, but there were some crazy ones where guys had to shoot unsupported. And again, there was the one where we watched a guy have another one of our group shoot his rifle, and that actually worked out for him because he got 50 points off of that string. So he chose wisely, and the other shooter cleaned it for him. So again, just kind of one of those nifty things. And then the stage 7, I did not take a picture of the actual stage briefing, so I don't have a stage briefing here. But stage 7 was interesting for me because it was an unknown distance stage. So there were 4 targets spaced out at unknown distances. You had to start from behind the line, again, chamber flag in, all gear in your hand on this go signal. You had to go up, drop down prone, load your rifle, and then engage the targets near to far, and then I believe it was far to near with a shot each, and you had to estimate as you went. Now, the benefit was we had all the ranges from the previous stage, and those targets were about 10 yards apart, so you could look at those targets and you could kind of guess. Now, the problem that we ran into is when you actually got on the gun, I screwed up because I didn't memorize the distance to the target or the order of the targets near to far while I was standing. And when I dropped down behind the gun and then you see them all on the same plane, I got out of order. And I know at least one of the targets, I engaged it thinking it was a different target than it actually was. So that was something to be aware of. Seeing some of the interesting ways shooters tried to do this, you didn't know the dimensions of the target, so you couldn't mill the targets. You didn't have enough time to mill the targets on the clock anyway. Range finders were not allowed, but you could actually go through this and try to mess with your parallax. One shooter actually did try to do that. If you had your scope maxed out on the highest magnification, so that depth of field was very, very thin, then you could twist your parallax knob, and if it was marked in yards and you were very, very accurate with your eye, you could get a general idea. But as you got out to a greater range, that, again, really didn't work all that well. So I used the time-tested scientific wild-ass guess, the SWAG, and did whatever I could to try to figure it out. And I got a couple of hits on it, without any problems. I got hits on the farthest target, and after we were done, I came off. I had my SIG Kilo 3000 BDX binos set up on a tripod. Those were what I was using to spot throughout the match. So it was easy once the match was over for me to go back and laze each one of those targets and get an exact distance to them. And I will throw those up on the side here. But nothing was really too crazy. One of the targets was slightly beyond 100 yards, but they were all close enough in that you could kind of hold high or low if you knew your 25, 50, 75, and 100. And I've got my dope from 25 to 100 in those increments, the 25, 50, 75, and 100. I have that memorized. But there were some other shooters that did some prior prep, and they went through and wrote down their dope for every 10 yards from 0 to 100. Now, that's not something I thought to prep going to another club match that was nearby. That is definitely something that I would do going out to nationals. I would definitely have my dope recorded in 10-yard increments or have it plugged into my ballistic calculator to where I can quickly call up the dope for any yard line in between. So if I was heading to the finale, that would be a little bit extra homework that I would do. So that is it for our description of the November National Rifle League 22 Course of Fire. Now, I did shoot this one in St. Louis, but I told them not to submit my scores. I'm going to shoot our local match for score, and that will be the one that they post on the NRL 22 site. And I really, really hope if you're in the area, you guys want to come out and watch or come out and shoot, please come on out. I usually bring an extra rifle to our club match. That way I've got another base class rifle, or I've got a spare rifle in case somebody's gun goes down. Or if you really want to shoot, you can come out and shoot my rifle. So I will leave details to that down below. We shoot at the Westside Sportsman's Club here in Evansville, Indiana, and that match is at the end of the month. So click the link down below if you want details. And that's it for this Mail Call Mondays. If you guys have any questions over anything that we've covered on this episode of Mail Call Mondays, leave it in the comments section down below or send it to us on Facebook or Twitter. If you guys want to know how to support the content that you have grown to know and love, then please check us out over on Patreon. We're posting more content over there that's exclusive content. You won't see it anywhere else. So please come over to Patreon and check us out. We would love to have your support over there. And until next time, get out and shoot.